well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Second Amendment.
As most of you know, that's my buddy Charlton Heston there reading the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Thanks for joining us again,
Lee. They don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't. That's my guy. Charlton Heston's my guy. But enough about Hollywood. We had what almost would have turned out to be a Hollywood-style shootout fairly local to us.
Yeah, like Heat.
Yeah.
Al Pacino and De Niro out there.
Yeah, but this was this was the real world. It in Crest Hill, Illinois, around 1 o'clock p.m. Two pairs, according to reports, because obviously I was not there firsthand, but according to reports, there was two pairs of individuals where an incident started in the town next to Crest Hill, and there was a little bit of cat and mouse and chase one another and ended up on opposing sides of the street. And again, according to reports, between the two pairs, about 40 shots, gunshots taking place from one parking lot to the next across a, I would say, moderately busy street, which is very concerning. One of the parking lots where two of the individuals were was at a very popular local restaurant, family-owned restaurant by the name of Marichka's.
Yeah, one of your favorites, one of my favorites too.
Absolutely, one of my favorites. I am there at least three times a month, and there's times it's two or three times a week. Wow. Ironically, my lunch appointment yesterday ended up being at a different location, although that one was mentioned during the discussion of where we should go. And for whatever reason, I ended up not being at that restaurant at that time. And I am very happy about that, because even though this happened in the parking lot, some of the bullets ended up shattering some of the restaurant's windows. So obviously there wasn't great aim by some of
the poor marksmanship, thankfully, for everyone involved.
And from what I understand, nobody got hurt, and can be thankful for that also, because 40 stray bullets flying around is quite a few. And
yeah, it seems like a lot, doesn't it?
It really does. When you know, you and I do a lot of shooting together in training, and if you think about what we do with 40 rounds, that's a lot of bullets flying across a two lane road. On one side of the road, it was a storefront, like retail plaza, and then obviously the parking lot to this restaurant on the other side. And I don't know if I want to use the word miracle, but it seems like that quite possibly could have been that nobody even got hurt.
Yeah, unreal.
It is. It's actually it's concerning. But then
that's the most, like, just sitting here. And I've been, you know, at this game for a little while now, and I pay attention to a lot of a lot of similar events that happen. I can't think of anyone that bumps into the 40 rounds exchanged.
No, that's quite a few.
Ballpark, yeah.
That's quite a few. And so then obviously there's been a lot of conversation between me and some of my friends and other acquaintances that I know that frequent that.
Oh, really? Wow.
Absolutely. Okay. And one of my friends, one of the first things he asked me is, he said, you know, what would you have done? Would you have gone out there and engaged with one of these guys in the parking lot? My immediate answer was, hell no. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the last thing that I would want to do. Everything that I have learned, trained, read, watched videos, talked to, conversations with lawyers, yourself as a trainer, the first thing you want to do is make sure that as an individual and your family and the people you love that are in your immediate vicinity are safe. And if that's happening outside the building and we were inside the building, I believe my initial reaction would be to move to a further back part of the restaurant that's away from the windows, preferably with some walls between us and the windows.
in a prior life, the term we used for it would be a hard point.
Okay.
Yeah.
But also strategically a defensible position.
Yeah, exactly.
Because in this instant, nobody entered the restaurant, but in another make-believe scenario or possible scenario, very well could have tried to retreat into the restaurant. And then there's other scenarios and conversations of what, you know, would have, could have, should have. But the last thing that I am doing is taking almost like a police officer or law enforcement role and inserting myself into that situation, because that is that's not what I'm there for.
Yeah, that's fraught with all kinds of potential problems.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Some of them being legal, and I would think some of them being legal.
Yeah, the physical,
and then
immediate physical harm is
the immediate physical
top of the, top of the list.
Absolutely. But
and yeah, it's a whole Pandora's box of
sure. And the where this happened is a pretty decent area.
Yeah.
Of the town. And that's what we've talked about. One of our podcasts, I'm not sure which one, but we talked about some of the firearms training, that it doesn't always happen in the bad areas of town.
Yeah, that's for sure.
This situation, the bad individuals came from the bad part of town. They left that area and came into a decent area. And that's why we say it can happen anytime, anywhere. Being prepared on several fronts, right? Not just with the firearm, but something you mentioned prior to us recording this was, if you're there with your family and, you know, something, a stray hits a family member or anyone that's just next to you, it's one thing to be prepared to defend yourself, but there's other levels of preparation. I think as a rule, do you typically have a tourniquet or first aid, like a trauma kit?
I'd be lying if I said it was on me at all times, but it's very frequently on me. A lot of times I carry some type of bag, and if you see me with a bag, there's first aid in there. So two kinds of tourniquet, one for adults, one for kids, one that works a little bit better with smaller limbs. I have younger children, and so I think about the potential of having to help them or someone else. And then, a trauma dressing and some quick clot gauze are things that I try to have. And then if they're not on me, they're always in my vehicle. That's nice, but, you know, to be honest with you, if somebody's arterial bleeding, that's literally life. Every beat of the heart,
right,
seconds, is life leaving that person. And the idea that I'd run to the car and have to run back, it's like that's an eternity.
Yeah.
So really, you know, having it on you is always the best.
So
if you could have it on you and have it prepped to go, is even better. Sort of like, you know, out of the packaging and ready to go, is even better.
So we've talked about, obviously, police responding to situations, and that's why being your own first responder in terms of your personal safety is a great idea. But we haven't really touched base on the phrase, when seconds matter, help is minutes away.
Yeah.
And that includes paramedics.
For sure.
And having the ability, the knowledge, and the equipment to react to that situation, I'll go out there and I'll out on a limb and say that's, you would need those skills probably more likely than skills with the firearm.
I think probably much more likely. The idea that you're going to get into some kind of, you can experience some kind of violent event that rises to the level of deadly force, and deadly force directed at you specifically or someone who you're responsible for, that seems highly unlikely to happen in your lifetime. But the likelihood that you'll experience someone being injured in a traumatic way is, well, I mean, I know, you know, we sort of talk about triggering events before we started hit the record button. You know, we were speaking about that event at Marishka's or outside of Marishka's. And my son, I was bringing home from jiu-jitsu a few years ago, and we're going down a country road, and we get to a spot in the road, and we just missed the accident itself, but there was a head-on. And there was a vehicle on the right side out in the cornfield with the lights still on. And then there was a vehicle sort of just off to our left, about 50 yards. I stopped. I told my son to stay in the car, and I ran out to see if I could help the person inside the car.
No kidding.
Yeah. And it was a triggering moment for me because I didn't have I had the training, but that night I didn't have the gear. And it turned out the person, from what I could see, was not bleeding out. It was a little bit difficult because it was dark and the airbags had gone off and had not deflated.
Okay, sure.
So it was tough, and I couldn't get some of the doors open. So I didn't have things to break windows. I didn't have gloves to keep myself from getting cut. I didn't have the things I would like. And so that was a triggering moment for me. I was like, here I am, a person who's willing to help and can help, and I don't have the stuff with me. And so that's what's gotten me to the point where I have in both of our vehicles, there's a kit that's ready to go with stuff that could help with bullet wounds, but other types of injury as well.
Gotcha.
And then the stuff that travels with me, like whenever I have a small bag and stuff like that, that's basically for stopping, for treating gunshot or stabbing wounds. But you can use it for other things as well.
That's interesting because in order to really be fully prepared for various incidents, first of all, it's a lot of knowledge and training to be able to contend with the various, almost endless situations. It's a lot of knowledge, training, equipment.
Yeah, it's a bit once you start thinking about things. And, you know, we sort of mentioned that. It's one thing, the medical stuff is, you know, mostly a feel good. If you could ever intervene for someone else or yourself and you do it in a medical way and save someone's life, that's always definitely turns out to be a feel good.
Oh, sure.
But the process of thinking about all those things, it's disturbing, right? Like you have to think about, you're thinking about worst case scenarios and then you're trying to prepare for them. A lot of people don't want to, you know, it's not always fun to go there.
Right.
And it's
uncomfortable.
And there's no, there are no guarantees. And I think that's the problem both in self-defense and first aid. You know, life is still precarious. You know, a lot of people come away with, you know, when you start looking at all these things more realistically, it tends not to have people get a warm fuzzy. And unfortunately, the things that most people like to do are things that give them warm fuzzies.
Sure.
Absolutely. Personal protection training, if you're doing it right, won't always do that. Neither will working with trauma medicine.
No, absolutely. The podcast that we had with Dave McDermott and one of his associates a few weeks back, I've gotten some feedback from some of our listeners, and they very much enjoyed it, but some of them also took away some of the reality of what's involved if you are involved in a situation with a firearm, and it's not, again, it's not Hollywood. Sometimes the reality means you could have been in the right, and you are still dealing with legal and or civil repercussions, and they're not pleasant. They absolutely are not enjoyable. But what it comes down to, in my eyes, is if I have to, as an individual, deal with some of those unpleasantries, but it was to save or protect myself or somebody I care about, then that's just the next step to deal with in that process of protecting those people.
The second 8 hours of my concealed carry class deals with all those legalities. And you could really come away with that. We'd have this discussion in class very often. You could come away from that block of instruction. And you say to yourself, well, why would I want to do this? Like, there's so many legal perils that I could find myself in, and especially in a place where you feel as though, from a Second Amendment perspective or a firearms owners or use perspective, that that it's aggressive, the legal system is aggressively against you. So when you combine those two things, people are kind of like the one, you know, throw up their hands. They're like, you know, I'd rather not do this. And on those days, I try to make it a point to show the cruelty and barbarity of attacks that have happened in real life. Because I just want to remind them, like, this is why we do what we do. There is a real thing called evil in the world.
Sure.
And sometimes it rears its ugly head, and when it does, every once in a while, it might be oriented toward you or someone you really love or really care about.
And it could be substantial.
Absolutely. And when that happens, there's no substitute for being prepared, whether it be with trauma rescue products or and training, or whether it's firearm products and the training that goes with it.
Yeah, and some of that, I would say most of at least the firearms aspect of it, it varies greatly based on the region that you're in. A lot of the conversation we had with Dave was focused on Cook County slash Chicago, and that is a very different, I'll say, climate than, say, Central Illinois, and a drastically different climate than, say, most of Texas.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, so much of that has just become political. And I hear on a regular basis, in fact, I heard yesterday at work, if you disagree with somebody politically or somebody disagrees with you against the Second Amendment, you shouldn't take it personally. And my immediate answer was, like hell. Because if somebody is disagreeing with me about the Second Amendment, that means they are trying to reduce my civil liberties. And it doesn't get much more personal than that. On various, not just the Second Amendment, whether you're talking about the freedom of speech. Or the right to privacy. As soon as somebody wants to reduce my ability to be a free human, it doesn't get much more personal than that on any level. But I think that a lot of people, again, because it's more comfortable, just rather not deal with it, think about it, and just go about their life, because most of the time, most people, they're not going to have to deal with it directly.
Yeah, I think it doesn't seem to affect them.
The odds are drastically in everybody's favor they'll be fine. Yeah, sure. But go talk to some of the people that have had to confront evil or were a victim of the evil, and I'd be willing to bet the vast majority of them would have preferred to have an additional option when dealing with it.
You would imagine.
So let me ask you this, Lee, because I know a little bit, about this, but not all of it. With us doing 2A today in these podcasts, what is some of your individual motivation? Or is there something or someone that sparked or triggered something in you that said, yeah, I'd like to be a little more vocal?
I think one of the main things that drives me is there are certain mysteries. There's human behavior that happens all the time. And it's been happening for forever. But even though it always happens, that we know, we learn so very little about it. And so one of the things that has always driven me was to sort of solve this riddle about violence. And I don't know if it was because of the violent neighborhood I grew up with, my household, my home life. Some people have a home life where it's violent. Either dad is violent, moms can be violent too. But I didn't have that experience. But certainly the neighborhood I grew up with was pretty violent. And I started seeing violent events from a pretty young age, about the age where your parents sort of let you start to drift away from the home just a little bit. So sort of go into a local park and
run around the neighborhood.
Yeah, right around the neighborhood. And we had a lot of gangs. And so I started seeing some things from a pretty young age. So maybe that's what sparked my, this quest that I've been on for most of my life to sort of learn my way around this thing called violence. But also I think maybe there's a part of it too that I've, you know, have always seen myself or view myself as part of being a man is maybe there's a protection component to
sure.
it. I've always felt like I've wanted to do the right thing. One of my favorite characters growing up, I read at a pretty young age. I remember reading the words coming to mind is the Canterbury Tales, but that's not what I'm looking for. It's King Arthur. I was at the public library and I got a paperback that told the King Arthur legends, and I really got enamored with Sir Lancelot. Lancelot was like the epitome of what a knight was supposed to be. And that, you know, that sort of superhero kind of attitude or just wanting to do the right thing and at the right times. So the superhero analogy never really, you know, resonated too much with me. We played superheroes with, you know, sure. friends and stuff like that, but that's not ever what I wanted to be. I wanted to be maybe a man who did the right thing at the right time. And so here I am, you know, 50 years later and trying to help people figure that stuff out and make it a little bit clearer because there are things that we should know about violence. You know, I train young people. I do my Managing Violent Encounters or I Bodyguard with young kids, teenage years. And I try to give them a head start on it to try to help them understand, like, why, how is violent interaction? A great person that really opened up to my eyes to a lot of things is Rory Miller. Rory Miller wrote several books, and anyone out there, they could do themselves a great justice by picking up some of his books and reading Rory Miller. He gets it and explains it in common sense language. And you can learn a ton about how people do violence just from reading his stuff. So, you know, I don't know. I feel like I've talked around a lot of things. There are also people that I really, I think my service, my military service, when you take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Second Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights, it's hard not to,
sure.
hard not to want to. Want to support
sure,
that gotcha. As well.
So,
go ahead, Joe.
So with some of your education through Castle Defensive, where you give the concealed carry classes and individual firearm training or group class firearms training, some of that was also based on the actual teachings, the to educate other people.
Absolutely. But in fact, when I first sort of got into this this field or industry, I'm a public school teacher. They our school district had an elective period where students at the middle school level could take a class that they were interested in. They asked us teachers, what would you like to offer as a class? And I just sort of said, you know, mental self-defense. I want kids to just have a better understanding about violent behavior, why it happens, what they could do to help negotiate themselves through violent events.
And you referred to that as mental self-defense?
Yeah. That's yeah. Just like, you know, what's between your ears?
Yeah.
And how could you understand it? Are there ways that you could diffuse it? Things like that. And my first 8-week class, kids stood up and were clapping. And I think I'm a pretty good history teacher, but I generally don't get applause, right? But you know, these kids are standing up and applauding at the end of this 8-week course, and I'm like, I remember getting embarrassed, and I asked one of the kids in the class. Some of the kids I didn't know before that class, but there were a few that I knew, and I remember asking him, like, "Are you guys being serious?" I sort of felt like they were pulling my leg, and he just looked at me. He's like, and he was a rougher kid, and I knew he would tell me if
right,
yeah, he wasn't gonna pull any punches. And he goes, "No, Mr. Cassie's like," he goes, "like, we so seldom get things that'll really help us in life. And I feel like this is going to like make a difference in my life."
That's great.
And so, yeah, that sort of was like, wow, I'm on the right track. And what frightened me is, you know, when I started teaching, I came straight from Iraq. Like, seriously, I was home for like 3 months and I went into a middle school classroom. And like and I've told this story many times. The first thing that I noticed is the teachers. And I was like, man, these teachers are like, they're the glass half full people of the world. They are so kind. They are, I always think of this picture that I have on one of my PowerPoints of a teacher, and she's sort of standing in the front of her classroom, and in the picture, it looks like she got a gift from her students, and she's got her hand on her chest, you know, and she's like, she's got this little heart in her hand, right? And like, those are the people, those in general, at least in my school and my school district, those are the people that are teaching our kids. Right? And I was like, wow, this is one of the reasons why I made on my part, very small sacrifices, deploying. This is why I do it. This is why I did it. One of the reasons. And then I started to get to know the students. And I was like, we have these kids that are just, they're great. People always roll their eyes when I tell them I teach middle school, but like, that's a bunch of baloney. Like, these kids are really, really good. They give me all kinds of hope, for the future. And so once I started to meet them, I was like, man, this is great. These kids are so much kinder than what my generation, I feel like my generation of the 1970s compared to these kids, they're smarter, they're kinder to one another. And like all the stuff that we're injecting into school seems to be getting people on the right track. I see kids of all all races, creeds, and colors in the hallway. They've got their arms around each other. People getting along.
Not that our media would right, support right.
Well,
that.
Right, right. Yeah, we don't want to. Let's not get reality mixed up with the media. Right.
Never let the truth get in the way of right. a good story.
Exactly. So, but then having been in a very violent environment for a couple of years, a year and then another, I was like, whoa, like we're kind of setting these kids up for failure. Like we don't give them that much adversity
mm-hmm.
where they're going to be able to power through
right.
some of the darker things in life.
And there will be some.
And I wound up finding a saying somewhere, and it was something along these lines. I think this might be Gavin De Becker, another person that everyone should read. It's incumbent on every parent to prepare their children for some of the perils in life.
I agree with that.
Yeah,
100%.
Anyone during the Middle Ages who had any means would have sent their child to learn to defend themselves with a dagger or what have you, right? You would have sent your kid up to, you would have sent your kid somewhere to learn the skills that they needed to survive. And we've really gotten away from that. So I thought that we should get back to it. And it wasn't long thereafter. I always wanted to include with my more mental self-defense side of the house, I wanted to include the physical skills that would go along with it, because you could do everything right and still wind up having to defend yourself. And if you do have to defend yourself, you better have, you better be coming with the best. And that's what led me out to Tony Blauer, and that's how I got. And I called Tony with this. I actually thought I wanted to be more in the law enforcement and military side, because that was my background in the military. And he sort of said, he goes, like, you're a teacher. He goes, how come you're not trying to do something with kids? And I was like, hadn't thought about that. And so I've been doing that ever since. I've been on a little bit of hiatus, but I'm going to bring back a course this summer. And
well, the Wuhan flu interrupted
it did.
That, just the ability for people to, one, have a place to do it. I'm sure there were all sorts of people, due to a lot of unknowns, were extremely reluctant to get together in any sizable group whatsoever. But I think most of that, from what I see, is behind us and can move forward again. So I guess anyone that's listening that would want to possibly have their child, their nephew, their niece, basically be able to get more tools in their toolbox, the mental aspect of it and the physical aspect of it, can reach out to Lee here at Castle Defensive and inquire about the next class.
Absolutely. CastDef.com. Fill out a form. Reach out to me. I'll be putting stuff together. Sort of circling back to this idea about sort of having the wherewithal. Had a young lady take one of my courses. Prior to taking my course, she was really struggling a lot with anxiety. And I'm seeing this with a lot of our youth. And I think if you talk to any educator, they'll tell you the same thing. They see a lot of kids out there who are really, really struggling with anxiety.
I've heard a lot of the same.
Yeah, and I think some of it is that when we've managed to, and this is what I noticed coming back from Iraq, when we've managed to shelter people, so young people, so much, and they haven't been exposed to much adversity, then everything becomes almost fear-inducing paralysis.
Yeah, everything's a hurdle.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, this young lady really, really was having a hard time with anxiety. She knew it. I offered the course, and at the end of the course, it's a very unique graduation. You have to face a role-playing bad guy, and you have to be able to get yourself through it. She took the course. She actually came back and did several other courses as helping me, but she swore to, you know, that really, really changed her. That really, her being able to face her fears in a really, really stressful situation made her live a more fuller life and do things that she would not have done if she didn't understand how to manage that fear and, like, get through that stuff.
That's great. That is rewarding.
It was one of the best stories. I've heard similar things, but I just knew her. She was a student, and I saw her struggle on a few occasions, and so I knew that what she told me was telling me was real. Super bright girl. Lots and lots of, you know, you see these young people and they have so much potential, you know,
mm-hmm.
And then for someone to be afraid to try things and do things, or when they do try things, to just get locked up with fear and make, you know, sort of like poor decisions. You know, that was a good one.
So that has to build a lot of confidence. It's actually them going through the process, and that confidence is being instilled in them because they're living that scenario,
yeah,
and they're overcoming it.
I think in a sort of way that is self-confidence, right?
Yeah.
It's the things that you face.
100%.
And then you struggle through them, and that's what it is. It's not, you know, it's not what people tell you.
No.
That gives you your self-confidence. Like, it comes from you and the things that you've conquered and achieved. And if we do too much for kids and we hold protect them from too much. It does. It sets them. I think of another image in one of my PowerPoints, and it's got like one of those stickers you get at for your shirt at conferences and stuff. Mm-hmm. It says, "Hello, my name is."
Right.
And I have this one that says, "Hello, my name is Victim." And that's sort of what we, you know, what our society in a certain, we've done wonderful things. Please, I'm not trying to be too critical. We do such wonderful things, but one of the things we haven't done well is prepare kids for those perils.
I agree with you. And that actually, in my mind, overlaps with some of the firearm stuff, and some of the mentality of being a victim. And I think that there are some people out there, whether they process it that same way or not, when they feel as though they have to depend on the government, by and large, the police department, they would rather stay in that victim mentality as opposed to saying, I am going to make sure I am not a victim, and I'll go through the training and I'll go through the necessary process to learn.
Yeah, in the first couple of years of me being back, I think I did struggle with some very mild post-traumatic stress. And I vividly remember looking into some veterans outreach kind of stuff. And I'd have to do some research and do some thinking to remember specifically who it is that I came across. But it was somebody that, someone I believe from the special operations community, that did like a public service video, for veterans with PTSD. And the thing that really meant a lot to me at that time was this person came on and said that, you don't have to look at yourself as being damaged or being a victim, that you could actually use your experiences. It actually can make you better. And the best use of it would be for you to help other people. And like, it was almost like a magic elixir for me. Like I've never felt as bad again after listening to that message, because a switch was flipped in my mind. And I was like, you know, because I think you could too easily fall into a victimhood narrative.
Sure.
And so it was, and I never really, you know me, I think we've had some conversations about this. I don't play the victim card very well or very at all.
Right.
I really wasn't, you know, feeling that way then, but even the best of us sometimes
we all have moments.
some weakness, right? And that really helped. And so
now you've been doing that. You've been taking your knowledge and your ability and helping others for how long? How long ago would you say that was?
I probably started doing, maybe even did the self-defense stuff, you know, prior to that. But that's at least going back to maybe 2010, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
2011.
For a long time then.
So it's been a little while. I enjoy it. I really, you know, I get a great feeling of seeing people reach their goals and accomplish their, you know, and some light bulbs come on, and seeing people like go, oh, and to have a more realistic view of violence and the dynamics that humans experience when they experience violence is very, very rewarding.
And shooting guns is fun.
And shooting guns is fun. So that's the fun part.
Yeah. But even when we're out doing some of that, we try not to always just stand stagnant and shoot at a steady target.
I try to do the best. It's always a contrived situation when you're at a shooting range.
Chances are, any of the scenarios we've practiced, no matter, because there's been a lot of them, if there was ever a situation, it's going to be different than what we've practiced.
For sure. The force on force is really where it's at. We have a group of guys that have been training a little bit, and I really want to get us. I want to get us there. That'll help. And once you can get into where you're doing more scenarios and where you can make those decisions and where you're actively having to detect the problem that's happening, when you're trying to diffuse it, when you're trying, a lot of the stuff we do at the range is at the very least equal initiative. Or where you have the initiative, you know, you're waiting for a buzzer and you know that, you know,
right.
you know that you're going to draw a firearm and shoot a certain amount of rounds. And as much as I could try to, as much as I try to do to maybe throw some chaos in that, at the end of the day, it's almost never where you're reacting to a stimulus, that causes you to engage. And, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road. The more practice you can do that. I mean, that's why the Air Force has Top Gun, right?
Right.
That's why, you know, that you, we want to put you in the most stressful situations and have you reacting to things. And if we can get you good at that, we know that you could be, unbeatable in air-to-air combat. The best thing is if you really, really want to be highly trained with this stuff, you gotta have that kind of, training experiences. And if, you know, if you could get four or five of those under your belt, you'll be pretty good, darn good with, if the real thing ever happened.
Just dealing with the stress.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of a situation.
Yep. The mind numbing stress that'll,
because it's usually not a gradual increase. It's usually everything is fine. And then the next moment everything is chaos.
Yep.
I'm sure yesterday at 12:57, At in Crest Hill, over at Marichka's, everybody was enjoying their lunch.
Yep.
And then before you know it, you know, you hear a few pops, and glasses breaking, and people are, I would assume, freaking out a little bit, screaming.
Yeah, and then a triggering moment for all those people in that experience that day, and what they'll do with it, I don't know. Some people will take steps to better prepare. Some people maybe will just not come out of their house.
Yeah.
You know, or not go to the, I hope no one chooses not to go to the, I hope people realize that, you know, that's not a, it's not a common event there, and it's not a common event. That's another thing I really have tried very hard with my efforts, is to get people to have a good, not go out of your house expecting that you're going to have to fight for your life that day.
Right.
But if you did, that you'd be ready for it. And so, you know, you don't have to live a paranoid life. I think that would be a very unhappy way to live. I don't live that way. I have a great time with my friends and family. I go out, I do things, you know, and then hopefully you just have that confidence of knowing that if something did happen, you could push through it mentally. But also that you're somewhat prepared. You'll never be prepared enough.
No, it's interesting you say that, though, because depending on the way you lived your life prior to carrying a firearm, it could be a bit of a shift. If you're the type of person that regularly stopped and maybe had a drink at lunch, or after work, 3 or 4 days a week, met up with some buddies, went to the bar, had 4 or 5 beers, if you're going to carry a firearm, there needs to be a shift in that ideology.
The lifestyle change.
And that lifestyle change. And for somebody, and that somebody I'm talking about is me, that has made a shift where carrying a firearm has become a lifestyle, it changes the way I operated daily a little bit. And there are times where I'll just say, maybe a family member or a friend will say something, kind of busting chops a little bit, going, why isn't Joe doing this? So we were on a vacation, and I traveled with a firearm and went to a state where it was 100% legal, and so I did that. But on vacation with the family, there's, you know, some consumption of alcohol, and now one of my brothers say, I wasn't drinking, and one of my brothers goes, "What, you think a pirate's gonna attack us over here? We're on a boat." Once you kind of make that shift into a difference of a lifestyle, it changes your day-to-day activities a little bit.
What a great adventure to be on, though, right? I mean, where you say to yourself in your life that you're going to take on as much responsibility as you could possibly handle, and then you're going to do it in the most conscientious way that you could possibly do it. Like, you're not only just going to go out and buy a gun, but you're going to train yourself well, and you're going to seek out the right kinds of information.
I have zero regrets.
Yeah, people sign up for all kinds of, you know, stuff to do in life, you know, adventure vacations and stuff like that. And you could do easily create your own adventure in life by just taking on that additional responsibility.
Yeah, especially if you really embrace it and then you enjoy it.
Yep.
It's
not for everyone.
No, it isn't.
Nor should it be.
I agree with that, but I would also encourage as many people to try it.
Yeah.
One of the individuals that I have followed for a long time, I have a ton of respect for.
Who's that?
I think it's Colleen Noir.
Yeah.
And I think that I've followed his videos. I've followed him for a long time. I've met him.
Really influential, like in this industry. Like, that's really cool. Right there. But real thoughtful. Thoughtful person.
And I think he's a pretty intellectual person, but doesn't speak to people in such an intellectual manner, breaks it down to a very common sense aspect.
Yeah, he's keeping it real.
He's, to be honest with you, he's part of my influence because I really, really admire a lot of what he says, a lot of what he does. And he's been doing it a long time now, and he started at a fairly young age, especially compared to, you know, when I started to decide to take on some of this individually and then hopefully as reaching out to some other people, you know, mid-40s already. And I think he started doing quite a bit of that, you know, 20 years prior, mid-20s.
Yeah.
Like I said, I've met him a couple times in passing. It wasn't, you know, a friendship or anything like that, but hope to meet him again.
Yeah, I'd like to just say that I know that people are out there listening, and I just wanted to say that, you know, I really appreciate that anyone that's out there and is giving the time to give a listen, and I hope that you continue to find something valuable in the conversations that I'm having with my friend Joe.
Yeah, and we're getting some positive feedback, and I really appreciate it. One of the things we do typically mention is encourage friends, associates to register to vote. We talked about our civil liberties. We talked about taking it personal. The only way that we change it to our favor is to vote in people and make sure our politicians know what is important to us. And I'm sure journalists really pay attention to make sure the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, is always protected. And us as a group of people that are firearm enthusiasts, we need to make sure that our politicians take our right to bear arms to heart and stick up for it.
That's their job.
That is their job. And
it should be their prime responsibility. Securing those basic individual rights is their job.
And our job as a community is to pay attention if they are doing their job.
Yeah.
Pay attention that they are doing their job, and if they are not, replace them with somebody that will. And it's really important, especially in this day and age with the internet. It's not difficult to look into what somebody stands up for.
Yeah.
Most of these politicians, I don't want to speak in absolute terms, but I would venture to bet all of them have a website.
Yeah.
And go there and see what's important.
I don't know any that don't.
Right, yeah. Me neither. But moving forward, I think what I'm going to attempt to do on our website, 2atoday.us, is do some preparedness and worksheets for the elections. And I am going to focus on the Second Amendment and who's sticking up for it and who isn't. And anybody that wants to find that information, it'll be on there in future podcasts. I'll let them know where it's going to be posted. But I'll do a lot of that research for people.
That sounds great.
And I'll put that information out there. And
that's brilliant.
It, for somebody that doesn't have, you know, the hours and hours to dive into it,
right?
You'll just be able to go to our website and look and, you know, see who is willing to protect our second.
And that's what the parties are supposed to do. But I'm not sure how much that's been working.
No, I would agree with you. I think. There's a lot of people that believe it, you know, it's a uniparty.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of nicknames for, you know, somebody that's on the left that leans right about things and vice versa. But there's a lot of important factors and a lot of important topics out there. it's impossible for us to cover all of them, but what I'm going to focus on our website is the Second Amendment and who's sticking up for it.
Yep. Let's do it. Well, thank you, Joe.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lee. And again, I want to second what Lee said. Appreciate everybody that's been listening and giving us feedback. And like I said, if there is a topic or something specific that anybody wants us to cover, we have some very interesting podcasts coming up. But drop us a comment, drop us an email on the website, and we'll make it happen on the podcast the best we can.